Stop 6. Rosland Park Lookout. From the police barracks, continue 50 metres along Police Barracks Walk to the gate, then turn left into Jail Road. After 100 metres, you'll see the lookout. It's the old poppet head on the hill, about 150 metres across to your left. Here's a song for the stroll. It's "The Good Times Are Coming" again, except you'll notice the diggers have now reworked the lyrics. When the song ends, pause this and then restart when you get to the lookout.
There's a good time a-coming, boys, a good time a-coming. When it will, it's hard to say, but I hope 'twill be someday. This good time a-coming. The comic song oft tells hard truth in place of weapons stronger. Son, now I'm going in to win, though wait a little longer. There's a good time a-coming, boys, a good time a-coming. Squatters shan't permitted be to overrun this colony, and the good time a-coming. An English girl shan't be allowed, the love and fire is stronger. To marry Flash John Chinaman, wait a little longer. There's a good time a-coming, boys, a good time a-coming. Camp officials shall have sense and try not to give offence in the good time a-coming. Some magistrates too will be found with love of justice stronger. And also know a little law, wait a little longer. There's a good time a-coming, boys, a good time a-coming. Not a shyster shall be sunk, nor a digger e'er seen drunk, in this good time a-coming. This good time a-coming. This good time a-coming. There's a good time a-coming, boys, a good time a-coming.
Okay, you should now be at the foot of Rosland Park Lookout. It's a poppet head. That is, the head frame from a gold mine, and it was shifted here from the Garden Gully United mine in 1931. As you climb, you can look down on the Bendigo Heritage Mosaic. Made by hundreds of volunteers, it tells a visual story of Bendigo's mining history. On the way up, there are plaques with information about the mosaic. So pause now and restart at the top. Phew! You should now be atop the lookout tower. Beyond Rosland Park is where we began, at the old post office with its tower and clock, and to the left of that, the adjoining government buildings. All around is Bendigo, which earlier in this tour I called an instant city, meaning it went from gold rush shelters to a city in a mere 20 years. It never was a town. Pall Mall runs from the old post office to the roundabout at Charing Cross, which we'll visit later. And below us is Rosland Park, which is Hyde Park via Shakespeare in Bendigo. From east to western end, no jewel is like Rosalind. Well, why not?
Bow, 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 yabbity, yabbity, yabbity.
And the Gold Rush settlers constructed their London in the Antipodes, in the country of the Jara people, who had lived here for thousands of generations. The Jara called gold karakara, but to them it was worthless. It was too soft for tools and too heavy to carry, so sure, they noticed it, but they left it lying on the ground. Instead, the Jara economy was based on husbanding this country for fruits, meat and other foods. Their culture revolved around song, dance and story. Their language, Jar Jar Warung, mapped every creek and gully and drew a tangible web between the land and every living thing. But the European and Chinese gold seekers were blind or refused to see the Jara network of meaning and ownership all over the country. So, like an arm brushing the black pieces off a chessboard, the Jarrah was swept aside, leaving the whites to turn the land into whatever they wanted it to be. In their hearts were hopes of a better life and the desire for freedom and wealth that was beyond their reach in the old world, a place with democratic rights where they could be citizens. So, as the Jarrah people lost their rights and country, out of the earth, European hands conjured rough stone into the buildings you see today. As one dreaming was obliterated, others' dreams were rendered solid in the sky. And as brick rose upon brick to create a new culture, the soundscape of the place also changed. If you were standing here in 1880, this is what you'd have heard. That's a noise we'd never tolerate in our neighbourhood today. It's a stamping battery, recorded at Bendigo's Central Deborah Mine, where it crushes quartz rock to sand to extract the gold. When the shallow alluvial gold gave out, Bendigo became a city of mining companies, sinking shafts for the gold buried deep in the quartz reefs. In Bendigo's heyday, there were 110 of these stamping batteries crushing the quartz. Can you imagine it? Stamping away, 24 hours a day, 6 days a week. Sundays they stopped so the Bendigonians could hear the church bells and themselves think. There were stamping batteries right here in the main street with the buildings growing up around the mines. No one could doubt that it was dust and industry that would fulfil the immigrants' dreams. They were living in it, and it was the ingenuity of the entrepreneurs and the muscles of the workers that made Bendigo rich. And Bendigo's wealth attracted creative people, such as the architect William Varland, who designed the watercourse you can see below, the Cascades. Constructed in 1880, it had statues, fountains, and a fern grotto, long since neglected, all gone. In 1997, the Cascades was partially reconstructed. And if it's running water, you can shout hallelujah, because it means the drought is broken. From here, you can see the Sacred Heart Cathedral and the Queen Elizabeth Oval. The grandstand there is a boomtime goldfield structure. It was built for the English cricket tour of 1901. You won't see many like it. Beautiful, isn't it? Just waiting for the Poms to return. Back along the hill where we've walked was all government camp, which makes this a good spot to tell you some more about the Red Ribbon agitation. You may like to listen up here at the lookout, or else take a seat on a bench back down at ground level. The Bendigo petition was taken to Melbourne for presentation to Governor La Trobe. On 13th of August 1853, about 10,000 diggers gathered near here at Viewpoint, within sight of the camp, to await the delegation's return from Melbourne.
Gully after gully hoisted its flag, and various nationalities were represented by different flags. The Germans in particular seemed determined to come out strong on the occasion, having ordered some splendid new banners for the purpose. The English nation was well represented by royal standards and Union Jacks, and the Irish provided themselves with a very beautiful flag with a harp in the centre, supported by a pick and shovel. But the one that attracted the attention was the Diggers' Banner, the Melbourne Herald.
The Diggers' Banner was first flown in December 1851 at the Monster Meeting on the Forest Creek Diggings. It was a flag divided into quarters, displaying the diggers' pick, shovel and cradle, the scales of justice, a bundle of sticks, and a kangaroo and emu. Unfortunately, the actual digger's flag no longer exists, but here's author Jeff Hocking recounting its design, as recorded by Goldfields writer William Howitt.
Well, Howard describes firstly the pick, shovel and cradle, and then he describes the scales of justice, which, to my way of interpreting this, are clearly a description of the scales held by justice outside the court of the Old Bailey in London. I mean, after all, these people are English, and they're describing something that everyone knows. Every Englishman would know the scales of justice and the Old Bailey, even if they've never seen it, the building itself or the sculpture, they would certainly know what it was and what it represented. And so many of the people on the diggings were, in fact, old convicts, so a lot of them would have passed beneath those scales. He also describes a bundle of sticks, and I'm inclined to believe that the bundle of sticks he described is very much like the Roman centurion's bundle, because they represent the bonding and unity of a group of men. It's the together we stand, divided we fall sentiment. And he describes the kangaroo and emu, which in my interpretation of the flag would show the kangaroo and emu with backs to one another, because we didn't see the kangaroo and emu fronting one another until after Australian Federation, when their main purpose was to hold the shield which held the symbols of the states.
The emu and the kangaroo, animals that cannot take a backward step, expressed the diggers' identity in their new land, and as many nations united, they awaited Governor Latrobe's response. The delegates who'd travelled to Melbourne returned to address the 10,000 diggers from the back of a dray. The governor, the diggers heard, would not agree to reduce the licence fee or put a stop to the digger hunts. Riled up though they were, the diggers refrained from violence. Rather, they decided to pay only 10 of the 30-shilling licence fee required and to paint on their tents the words, "No licence taken here." Governor Latrobe, however, feared that the diggers' protests were not just about attacks, but also about red republicanism. Jeff Hocking.
What the government didn't want to have happen here were all those revolutionaries from Europe, and there are a lot of people from Hungary and Eastern Europe that come, and Italians and French, people who, I mean, the French were really troublesome because they'd become a republic, they'd executed most of their aristocracy, and they were seeding the American movement, and they were seeding Irish republican sentiment. I mean, they were assisting all of those countries across Europe who were rising up against their aristocracies and the traditional method of government. Britain was absolutely in fear of that taking hold in Australia.
So, did the governor's fear have any foundation?
There were groups of who came from different countries that marched together. I mean, the Germans were very strong in Bendigo and they marched under the black, red and gold flag. The Irish marched under a long green cloth on which was the Harp of Erin. The English marched together, the Scots and the Italians, and there were all sorts of people in Bendigo. But when they stood outside what is now the Bendigo Art Gallery, up there on View Street, they stood there and someone was ranting and raving about Queen Victoria and down with the Queen and all this kind of stuff. And the English contingent turned on them and started singing the national anthem and singing God Save the Queen, saying, "This is not a political argument. This is actually just about taxation." And they didn't want in any way that argument to be overshadowed by this kind of concept of political change.
It was on the diggers' agenda that they should eventually get a vote, but this was a long way from overthrowing the monarchy. However, Governor Latrobe, sipping his morning tea in Melbourne, had other political pressures, particularly from Earl Grey, the British Secretary of State for the Colonies, who constantly urged Latrobe to be on his guard against the dreaded Red Republicans. And so, upon draining his tea, Latrobe dispatched another 154 troopers to Bendigo. Said Latrobe, "The diggers were grievance mongers, and if they troubled the government much more, he would let them hear how the cannon could roar." Fortunately, the Bendigo Gold Commissioner, Joseph Panton, was a measured man. Jeff Hocking again.
And the trouble is that most of the, especially in Ballarat and in Castlemaine, most of the gold commissioners and troops that were sent here were not the sort of people who were good at handling unruly mobs of diggers. They arrived in their flash uniforms, and a lot of them wore white gloves. all the time, so they actually wouldn't have to touch the digger at all. When the pound note was handed over, they kept their gloves on so they wouldn't be soiled by actually touching the digger's goods. And people resented them. It was actually a bit different in Bendigo. The Bendigo, the regiment sent to Bendigo were controlled by a young man called Panton, who was smart. He'd been to Sandhurst. Apart from being smart, he was a humanitarian, and he actually understood when the diggers complained in Bendigo. Panton actually understood what they were talking about. It didn't mean that they were able to get away with anything, but it wasn't like Ballarat, where the police, the troopers, the publicans, everyone were corrupt. They're all on the take in Ballarat.
When a delegation of diggers met with Panton and offered their 10 shillings instead of 30, Panton refused, but he did agree to represent their concerns to Governor La Trobe. The second meeting was set for a fortnight later, but many diggers were losing patience. In those days, tea chests were lined with lead, and in the fortnight's wait, every tea chest in Bendigo was stripped of its lead lining. In the hidden creek beds, the diggers were turning the lead into bullets. And that's where we'll leave the diggers until the next instalment of that story. Next, we'll take a walk to some of the houses that reveal the structure of old Sandhurst society, beginning with Dudley House, stop number 7. Directions are at the beginning of track 7.